Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you're listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us David D. Horowitz, who founded and manages Rose Alley Press in Seattle. In 20 years, the press has published 16 titles, including his latest poetry collection, Cathedral and High Rise. His previous poetry collections include Sky Above the Temple, Stars Beyond the Battle Smoke, Wildfire, Candle Flame, Resin from the Rain, and Street Lamp, Treetop, Star. David's poems have appeared in Candelabrum, The New Formalist, The Lyric, The Smoking Poet, Quill and Parchment, and many other journals, and his essays regularly appear in the online journal Exterminating Angel. He often organizes and hosts readings in the Seattle area and maintains his website at rosealleypress.com. Welcome, David.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, Sheila, and look forward to what you have to ask me.
Thank you. And we're excited to be talking to a Northwest poet and publisher and sharing that with our Port Townsend community, as well as more widely through the wonders of the internet and streaming. So what I would most like is to begin by hearing some of your poetry.
I'll be happy to read some poetry. How about I start with two short poems, poems that I typically read and that I think make a good statement about where I start from, what I think is important. Ballpoint. Slim implement, bless your ink, no matter what its scribe might think. Print black or blue or green or red, the hand that writes can free the head. The tyrant fears you like the gun. You liberate his slaves, one by one. Sparrow. I'm an ounce of flit and bounce, an inch of hop and flinch. I chirp and chatter, perch and scatter, alert. Still, the world can kill and think it doesn't matter.
Thank you.
So that's where I'd start, and I'll have a few more opportunities to share some other poems.
Yes, you will.
But concern for free expression and concern for precise expression and ethics, cultivating a conscience, being aware of suffering around us and the need to try to alleviate it, themes that are near and dear to me, the violence in the world and how we can kind of delimit it, what we can do to make our own hearts a little less angry. I think that that's a place to start. As
yes,
I said, I'll have
is.
A few more poems to share.
These two poems certainly show your use of rhythm and rhyme and influenced by form. Also, what strikes me is they're about big things, but they start by focusing on something ordinary in our lives,
yes.
Like a pen or the sparrow, which is not necessarily a glamorous bird, but it's a bird that we all frequently see and maybe don't even take note of anymore. And I like
yes.
the way you read that one in the little voice of the
yes.
sparrow. That is, I think, a real talent to be able to take on the big elements that you're talking about, our angry hearts, politics, the state of the world, and to absorb the listener or reader of your poems in those arguments and perceptions by allowing us to ingest them through these small, seemingly harmless
yes.
moments. You are definitely a poet of great observation of the moment and of persona. Tell me about how you came to writing poetry.
Many years ago, and by the way, just as an aside here, in relation to detail and vision, I have a saying that occasionally I remind myself of and mention to other people, be inspired by vision to focus on detail. That it's the vision that keeps you motivated, but it's the detail that really is what's communicated to other people and what other people see. So there's a relationship between the two. Ideals and details should be intimately related. Now, as far as my beginnings as a poet, when I was had moved to Seattle with my mother, who got a job at the University of Washington as a political science professor, we moved here in August of 1971, and we lived in a house on Greenwood Avenue North, overlooking the wondrous, wonderful Olympic Peninsula with the brothers, those wonderful mountains, the Olympic Mountains and the Olympic Range. And I would frequently note the sunsets during the summer, especially, that were just amazingly beautiful. And even just looking down at Ballard and looking out at Puget Sound, the sunsets and how they were affecting the water and the light and the evergreens, it was just amazing. So I was taken with that. Now, I started keeping a journal when I was going to Lincoln High School in Seattle between my junior and senior year in 1972, and then a little bit later I took it more seriously, 73, 74. I was just writing down phrases and noting observations and just keeping a little journal of poetic inspirations. Well, one evening, in roughly, I'm going to say about August 1974, I noted the incredible beauty of the sunset, and I felt compelled to try to describe what color I had just seen, and I couldn't do it. I would go back day after day after day, evening after evening after evening, to a spot around 45th and Greenwood, and just think, what is that color? And I would come up with red, pink, orange, orange, red, green, green, orange, you know, brown. I couldn't nail it. After about 3 weeks of this, it hit me. Salmon. That's the color. Salmon. It described what the color is, not only the denotation of salmon, but also the connotation of salmon, the fish, as a Northwest icon, fit perfectly with the word salmon as a description of the sunset color. And so I was just absolutely bowled over that this word had so much power to describe something concisely. So instead of four or five words with hyphens between them, I found this one word which powerfully, concisely, and precisely described this scene and implied the mood and the landscape as well. So right at that point, I said, you know what, this is so wonderful a feeling that I've found this precise word that I have to keep this going. I'm going to have to write poetry. I'm going to have to keep this going because the pleasure of finding the precise word, the precise expression is so intense.
Thank you. Were you reading poets at the time?
I was not reading too much poetry. I did start to read poetry about maybe a year or so after the event that I just described. I was reading some, took some classes in Shakespeare at the UW, and I also started buying poetry books on my own, Robert Frost, Wordsworth, Coleridge, pretty standard poets. I would also buy an occasional newer book of a contemporary poet. And my tendency was not to be as fond of that work. Even though many of them were highly praised, I felt that they just weren't all that great. And I loved rhyme, and I could see, obviously, that rhyme was out of fashion and regarded as anachronistic and kind of hopelessly tinkly, metronomic, and mediocre. I didn't feel that way about it. I felt rhyme was essential. My last quarter at the University of Washington, I thought, you know what, I'm going to take a poetry writing course. I did. The only course I ever took was William Dunlop's Introduction to Poetry Writing, and it changed my life.
How so?
Because William, he introduced me to a poet named Philip Larkin, a great British poet, and here was a contemporary rhymer. He also liked Richard Hugo. I liked Richard Hugo. He also liked Denise Levertov and some other contemporary non-rhyming poets, but he introduced me to Philip Larkin. I read Philip Larkin's The Wits and Weddings every day in 1978 because I wanted to learn how to write in rhyme, but in a way that didn't sound tinkly and metronomic and dated, that sounded contemporary. So I studied it. I lived with it. I've been reading Larkin the last week. That's how long my sense of loyalty is deep. So that's, in a nutshell, basically how I evolved from kind of standard, textbook kind of rhyming classical poets to more contemporary voices like Philip Larkin.
This would be a wonderful time to hear more of your lines. Can you read us a bit more?
Yes. Rising prices for victims of a marketplace bombing. In Baghdad, for vegetables, some beg, and others pay an arm and a leg. Rough day. Today, 10 terror bombings in Iraq, a rape and murder down my block, an apricot translucence, quarter moon of silent distance yielding to maroon, black night. This brawl of appetite, most life can rest and and dream till dawn, the bruising light. Water of the Tigris. A bomb in Baghdad booms, then flames and chars, apartment fronts and blocks of dented cars, explodes wood crates of dates and figs, clay olive jars and silver trays of baklava and burek. Black smoke still smolders from an ancient Buick. A face-down corpse still clutches loaf of bread. The muddy Tigris flows a drop more red. Near mosque, a mother weeps at wall, at stars. And the last I'll read just right now.
Okay.
Don't forget. Jay hollers, "Don't forget Bar Kokhba." But P shouts, "Don't defend al-Nakba." Jay hollers, "Don't forget Masada." But P shouts, "Remember Intifada." Jay hollers, "Auschwitz, the pogroms." But P shouts, "You forced us from our homes." Both shout, "They started this. Bomb, flame the enemy, and stoke eternal blame." Jay hollers, "Now you killed my mother." But P shouts, "Your troops shot my brother." Jay thinks, "Shalom, salam, they rhyme."
Oh, thank you, David. We are all caught in the crossfire, is what I'm getting from your poetry and yours.
Yes, I think that is very, very well put. Very well put. And to just briefly comment on the earlier comment about violence and addressing violence in our own hearts, I think really addressing violence in our own hearts is where I would start. I think sometimes, especially sometimes in the poetry scene, there's a little bit too much of a judgmentalism about what other people should do and who the enemy is. And I think we have to start by looking in the mirror and taking seriously what the cruelties that oneself, you know, your own self are capable of. So yes, we are all caught in the crossfire. We all maybe need to be aware of that and to cultivate the empathetic awareness that can get us to the next place. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, thank you. Don't be sorry. This is an important lesson, and also an important lesson about what poetry can do for the world, which many of us don't think of it as powerful, and yet look at the power that's possible if we really listen to the poet's words. So I want to thank you again.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 Port Townsend. In case you've just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Today, Sheila Bender talks with Seattle-based poet David Horowitz about his Rose Alley Press, his work in rhyme and meter, and his ideas on poetry.
I'd love to talk about your publishing endeavor. It's not every poet who also starts a press. I'd love to hear about the history of it, the poets you've published. I know some of them have gone on to win nice awards, in fact, some very recently, and how you feel about publishing poetry in today's environment. So anywhere you want to jump in with that would be fine.
That sounds great. Well, in 1995, I founded Rose Alley Press. It's 20 years ago, and I'm still going with Rose Alley Press. I felt there were some important things I had to say, and there were some important things other people had to say that I needed to help them publicize. One, I had been through various experiences with religious organizations, and I was not happy about how they were managed, and I was very much not happy about the sense of choice that was presented to most people, that there's kind of the Bible or atheism. And I'm kind of articulated a non-biblically based theism, a not anti-Judeo-Christian, it would be too harsh, but non-Judeo-Christian theism. And that's very important source of inspiration to found Rose Alley Press. I published my first book on the press called Strength and Sympathy, a book that I wrote articulating a kind of a newer form of deism centered on consideration and vitality. Consideration is one of my favorite words because it's a word of inclusion and balance. You can be considerate, you're loving and sympathetic, and you're also rational and thoughtful. So that was one inspiration. Another inspiration for Rose Alley Press was, as you mentioned, rhyme, and being evident in my poetry, formal poetry, often being looked at in stereotypical ways that don't reflect how essential it is, really, I think, to our nature. I think of rhyme as related to symmetry in our bodies. It's a metaphor for connectedness. It's about connecting with something similar, and often similar in ways that contrast, sometimes similar in ways that are suggestive of a scene, and you can create a more beautiful scene by having these similar sounds, and also the symmetry in our own bodies. We have our eyes rhyme, our ears rhyme, our hands rhyme. And then meter, I think of as being related to pulse. Our bodies have a pulse. Our bodies are operate on a kind of a metrical basis if you listen to your heart. So I think of it as very essential to our bodies, not just some imposition of 17th and 18th century aristocratic privilege. I think of it as basic to our bodies. So I'm really very inspired by rhyme, by independent thinking, by free speech, by innovative views of religion. And so with that in mind, I started Roselli Press, naming it after an incident in the life of John Dryden, where Dryden was nearly beaten to death, but he came back and he wrote some of his best work. He just wouldn't be silenced. And I was inspired by that. So I began by publishing Strength and Sympathy. I published a book, a chapbook by a friend of mine at Seattle Central Community College, with whom I shared an office when I taught there for a while, Victoria Ford. And then I mentioned William Dunlop before. Well, then I asked William Dunlop, my former teacher, British fellow, magnificent poet, to publish his book, Caruso for the Children and Other Poems. It wasn't called that at the time, but that's what it became. It was a difficult experience in a lot of ways. It was inspiring. It was wonderful. It was frustrating. It was all of those. We took a long time to get his manuscript into shape. He had more or less given up on poetry, a magnificent poet who I felt had been overlooked, underappreciated, while lesser talents were getting the spotlight. And so we published that in 1997, and it was kind of a hit. It really sold a lot of books, and that book eventually sold, I think it's 742 copies or something like that. It was wonderful to have a book that I thought was great, that I was inspired by, that was a friend of mine, and somebody that I could repay a favor. I mean, he had introduced me to Larkin, and now I was returning the favor to get his work out, and it was just wonderful. I published Michael Spence's second collection, Adam Chooses. Michael, a wonderful poet, extremely well published, and he had had difficulty finding a publisher, partly because he writes in rhyme and meter. That's, you know, there are prejudices, and it's difficult to overcome them. And I published other books by other folks, Joni Stangland, marvelous Seattle poet, Douglas Shooter, also wonderful Seattle poet, Donald Kentop, published his collection in 2004 on Paper Wings. I wanted to focus on getting more poets into the fold, so I published two anthologies, one in 2007, Limbs of the Pine, Peaks of the Range, and then in 2010, Many Trails to the Summit, and those were quite successful, and almost 500 copies sold, and that's nice. Most of the work, though not all, is in rhyme and meter. Much of it is in form, a lot of sonnets, villanelles, and the like, and I feel great about it. It's contemporary-sounding work. It sounds very much like it's of now, and a lot of the poets who submitted work, the formal work, are not known as formal poets, but they were writing formal poetry on the side, thinking, well, it's not going to get published, but they just like to write an occasional sonnet. Well, I do like to publish that kind of work, so everything just worked out wonderfully, a wonderful synchronicity of purpose. The two anthologies were really nice, and I'm thinking it's a possibility I might do a third one. While I was publishing this other work, I was publishing my own collections, getting a lot of poems published in journals, but publishing my own collections. I should note that another inspiration for this is I've seen a lot of writers spend 5, 10, 15 years banging their head against a wall trying to get their work published by a major publisher or by an important regional publisher, and not getting successful, not finding the kind of success they hoped to achieve, and just feeling very, very frustrated. I didn't want to be like that. I don't want to be like that. I don't care about prestige. I mean, I like recognition. I'm not a hypocrite about this. Of course I like recognition. Of course I like when I get a little bit of fame. Yes, of course. But I don't really need to have my work published by Random House or even an important regional press like Copper Canyon. I'm happy publishing it myself. I don't care.
Well, yeah. It's a good argument for many things. And one of the things I am listening for as you speak is your commitment to poetry, your commitment to that vision in details fuels, I think, your energy for getting the work out there and for not,
yes,
for having the confidence that to get it out there is important rather than playing a game of getting published by famous publishers.
Yes.
And then to give that gift to other people is really significant to me. Your teacher, poets of the Northwest that you have known or shared offices with.
Right.
And to promote your vision of a contemporary rhyming poetry. When I was in graduate school, my argument with poetry wasn't about rhyme and meter, because I do write in blank verse, but it was about confessional versus okay poetry. I was reading poets who were, before I went to graduate school, they were dubbed confessional poets. By the time I got to graduate school, that was a very inappropriate kind of poetry to be writing, whatever that was.
Right.
Because these people were winning awards, and people were would go out of their way to say, I don't write confessional poetry. My poetry is not confessional. And I would read all this poetry, and I would think, it's from their lives. It's from their lives. What I don't understand this. And so there's the game always being played, and I really admire your acute ear for the way rhyme and alliteration, which I hear a lot of in your poetry and even in your speech about poetry, how we need to own it ourselves if that's the way our heart and ears and minds work.
Yes.
And so as poets, we have individual voices and commitments, and it's not easy to keep the commitment. You mentioned that Dunlap had been done with poetry and was kind of sad about the state of his lack of publication. And there you came in and honored it. And I know the numbers sound big if you're a poet, 700, 500, 400 books.
They're
small if you're just in the publishing world in general and the big publishers.
Right.
So important to keep our voices, our unique voices alive. And I really admire your niche.
Thank you.
And that you've stuck to it and put out such wonderful books, including your own. So that brings me to wanting to hear more, if you have more to read us.
Thank you. I most certainly do. I'll read these two poems. This one that I'm going to read is the first poem in my new book, Cathedral and High Rise. And then the second poem I'll read is a poem I published about 10 years ago in a different collection, Wildfire Candle Flame. So, extension. Hand separates to fingers, fringe, and forearm leads to elbow's hinge. There's beefy bicep bulging strength and shoulders sloping into length. My hand, a tool to help me reach, snare, tie, connect, release, free, read, compose. My fingers fringe my hand and join yours, bridging island, land. Affix. Scotch tape. Your role is clear. Stick with it. Persevere. Seal up container lids. Rejoin torn parts. Bridge the disparate and calm the desperate and help the broken feel reborn.
David, thank you. I like the way Scotch tape frames your reading for us today so nicely as I refer back to pen. I like so much the way you look at the small objects and bring in huge human tendencies and attributes.
But this is, it's an important point to emphasize that detail is where idealism lives. The 20th century is replete with the words and brutalities of ostensible idealists who ignore the feelings, aspirations, resentments, problems of individual human beings. One doesn't really change the world in terms of huge collective masses and addressing people that way. It's through quiet persuasion. It's through quietly recognizing the excellence of something, the importance of something that you took for granted. It's about recognizing the complexity of the emotions of a person right next to you and willingness to address that and how you address that person. It's about showing tact and consideration in a conversation, not bullying people. So I am very much a believer in changing the world in some very fundamental ways, but I'm not going to get on a soapbox and holler at people about who their enemy is. I'm going to show them a little something that they forgot or ignored or has been taken for granted, and all of a sudden they realize, aha, that's wonderful. My day's a little better because I know I recognize that and see how wonderful it is. And my vision of life now is changing because I'm seeing all kinds of things I've been taking for granted. So I might not identify myself as a revolutionary, but I am a radical for empathetic awareness.
I love that. Let's say that again.
I am a radical for empathetic awareness, and that means recognizing the full complexity of things, not just cheapening things into stereotypes so you have something to support or bash. And it's in that complexity that that marvelous detail lives, and it's also that complexity that makes writing good poetry difficult. As W.H. Auden once said, that poetry is the clear expression of mixed emotions. And I don't always agree with that, but I think there's a lot of truth in it. And it's not cheapening things to fit stereotypes, but giving them their full, complex life and letting that voice emerge. Sincerity, to me, is very important, not fashion following. It's important to be open-minded. I'm not dogmatic about form. There are lots of good free verse poets and lots of bad formal verse, to be sure, but I think that there's a music, and for me, poetry is the intersection of language and music. There's a music in formal poetry that we've often forgotten, and that helps language resonate more deeply in us. So form is wonderful and reflects virtuosic skill when it's used intelligently and thoughtfully and skillfully. But at a more deep emotive level, I think language resonates when we sense structure and pattern, almost like the backbeat in a rock song. You're more moved to react to it. And I feel that way about form and poetry. I feel that way about voice. Whether it's confessional or whether it's you're writing dramatic monologues, you're writing about other people, you certainly are drawing from your own experience. You still need to focus on precise diction, surprising turns of phrase, imagery that makes it easier to kind of get into the emotional experience in the landscape.
I want to say about the poems you just read and all the poems you read today, they all take me back to what you said early in our conversation about rhyme being in our bodies, how our ears rhyme and our eyes rhyme, and all that symmetry is about rhyme. And I think about the lesson you're giving us about being our authentic selves, remembering our humanness and our compassion by looking at details. And I see the gift of sound in poetry now, suddenly today, as having yet another aspect, and that is to bring us back to our human selves in a sound way.
Yes.
In both meanings of the word. Because the electronic and mechanical sounds we're privy to so much of our days, every day, are not the same as the ones you're exploring. So that's another gift your poetry and your focus on rhyme and alliteration mean. And the poems you read at the end certainly have all that alliteration. Words in a row with the same beginning letters, the B's and the S's were in there. David, I want to thank you so much for being with us today, for sharing your poetry, your history with poetry, the poetry of others, and how significant meter and rhyme are to you and to us as listeners. I've learned a lot today. I want to tell our listeners that you can reach David at his website, www.rosealleypress.com, and his new book, Cathedral and High Rise, Poems by David D. Horowitz, is available. Thank you again, David.
Thank you. It's been a complete pleasure, Sheila. Thank you.
You have been listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life with Sheila Bender. For more of Sheila's interviews, please go to Sheila's website, www.writingitreal.com/audio. In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman. Announcer is Kurt Vanderslice.